Good morning and welcome to St. Paul's Bible Study. We are looking at the book of James in chapter 4 today. And so I beg your patience as we wait for people to arrive in the room, and we will get started presently.
Hi, Sarah. How are you doing?
I'm well, Jeanette. How are you doing?
Good.
Morning, Liz. We'll wait just a couple of moments for everyone to arrive.
Sure. Hello, Grace.
Good morning, Grace.
Good morning.
How's the weather in Florida?
Sunny and up 74.
Oh, wow.
I shouldn't have asked. What part of Florida are you in?
I'm like 17 miles north of the Fort Lauderdale Airport in a little town called Margate.
Very nice.
I'm like 7 miles from the ocean. Mm-hmm. So we always have a beautiful breeze.
Mm-hmm. I was born across the bay from Tampa, so Florida has a warm place in my heart, as it were.
My two granddaughters live over in Tampa, and they were here last weekend to visit us.
Mm. How nice.
With my great-granddaughter.
Do they live in Florida full-time?
Yes.
Mm. Cool.
Thank you. Come back, Grace.
You know, I have a, that Mariah player, was that from the people in Greenland? Do I have that right?
New Zealand.
Oh, no, New Zealand, Maori.
Okay. I just wanted to get that straight in my head.
It's from the Anglican Church of Aotearoa, New Zealand and Polynesia.
Is that an area where the natives primarily live?
I'm sorry, what was that? Let me turn my phone off.
Is that an area where the natives primarily live?
Is that what?
Is that an area where the natives primarily live?
That is a tricky question because there are no native humans in New Zealand. There are no indigenous humans in New Zealand. The Kiwi, the birds, are indigenous, that's it. And in fact, there are no indigenous mammals in New Zealand. So one of the things they acknowledge is that everyone traveled there. Some people just got there first. And so there are three islands in New Zealand. Two of them are extremely large, one of them is very small. And in the North Island, there are more Maori than Pakeha. In the South Island, there are more Pakeha than Maori. But the church, the Anglican church there, is organized in a fascinating manner because it has geographically overlapping dioceses. And so there are Maori dioceses that predominantly serve the Maori folk whom you might imagine to be indigenous, but in fact, they just got there first. And then there are the Pakeha dioceses, and the Pakeha is the Maori word for white person. And so it's the conglomerate group of not Maori. And so the Pakeha dioceses serve primarily Pakeha, but you know, also any Maori who want to come to church and express their Christianity in that way. And so I served an internship for a summer, which would be their winter, in a cathedral in one of the Pakeha dioceses But because it was the cathedral, it also had mixed language services. And so some of the services were both in Maori, or portions were in Maori and portions were in English. And it was fun. And the cathedral staff was made up partially of Pakeha and partially of Maori. And it was a wonderful experience. And then I was half time in a cathedral in a large city, and then half time in a rural parish that comprised seven structures, like seven church buildings. Sure. One of which was a tiny little chapel up in the Alps. And so half the time it was pastoral care over the sheep fence, and half the time it was helping to reorganize aspects and do grunt work in a cathedral. So, but the answer is no.
So the people who moved into New Zealand, those places you were talking about, where did they come from?
Okay, so the Maori were not the first people. The Moa hunters were the first people. Sorry, we're a little off topic, but we're gonna wind this up. The Moa hunters were the first, and they came from somewhere in Polynesia. The Maori, but they died out, possibly because the Moa died out. The Maori came next, and again, somewhere in Polynesia. If you've ever seen the Disney movie Moana, those gigantic outrigger canoes that can carry many people over a shockingly long distance, boom, that is how the Maori got to New Zealand. And so they were next, and then the Europeans in the colonization and expansion were third. And New Zealand was a more lately colonized colony of various European nations, not as quickly colonized as some other places. And so there are families who, it's still in their memory, though not their living memory, of coming and settling and becoming farmers, which is a high status thing in New Zealand to be a farmer. And so it's interesting because I had some of those conversations too, where, you know, the extremely old member who is of the family, who is the patriarch, he remembers his grandfather telling him stories about coming in some of the first, second, third waves of colonists to New Zealand and getting a land grant and becoming a farmer. And so, you know, the grandchild wasn't around at that time, so it's not quite living memory, but it's twice removed from living memory, or really once removed. He spoke with the person who did it. So younger than some of our churches, really. On that happy note, let us transition to the book of James and the fact that we are on the penultimate chapter, chapter 4. I have been paying attention. And we are going to need to think about what we would like to study after the book of James. Pardon me. And so if anyone's got suggestions right now, lay it on me and I'll write them down.
How about, given your comments several weeks ago, you pick one that you have the background already organized. Give you a little Lenten pressure.
So long as it's an actual book of the Bible, it's okay. If I'm going to suggest one, it's going to be the Gospel of Thomas. And you may not be interested in studying a non-canonical Bible or a non-canonical book of the Bible. So
how would we get it?
How would you get it? I can get you to a website. If someone will send a group email, I can get you to online resources where you can read it there. You can purchase it. There are a number of good good commentaries that include the text. So if you just want the text, you can find it online. If you want the text and another commentary, I can point you to some of those. And if you don't want to study the Gospel of Thomas, that's okay. That's okay. You don't have to. Jeanette, for some reason, I can't hear you again. I know, you're looking right at the camera.
Oh, can't hear you.
I'm sorry. You know, maybe people should talk to the vestry and see about them updating their rules about in-person meetings. Because we could still have Grace using the OWL and doing Zoom, and then we'd be able to hear Jeanette really reliably. Which would be great because she has great additions and we want to hear them.
Yes.
Okay, so because we're not able to all participate in this conversation, Jeanette, will you send an email to everybody and we can all respond with comments and additions and maybe other suggestions of other books that you might also like to study. Thank you, appreciate that. Okay, so let us move on to James chapter 4. Is there someone whose mic reliably works who would like to read James chapter 4 for us? Grace, you're going to do it for us? Great.
Sure.
Here we go.
Since therefore Christ suffered and is fresh, arm yourselves also with the same intention, for whoever has suffered in the flesh have finished with sin. So to live for the rest of your earthly life, no longer by human desires, but by the will of God.
Grace, I'm just gonna stop you for a moment. I'm so sorry. Are you on chapter 4 of James?
Yes.
Okay, your version is just vastly different from ours. Please forgive me. Continue.
You have already spent enough time in doing what the Gentiles like to do, living in I'm not gonna get this out of my mouth right.
Okay. Can I get another volunteer to read in a different version of chapter 4?
Yes, the
All right, Donna's gonna do it for me.
Those conflicts and disputes among you, where do they come from? Do they not come from your cravings that are at war with you? You want something and do not have it, so you commit murder. And you covet something and cannot obtain it, so you engage in disputes and conflicts. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly, in order to spend what you get on your pleasures. Adulterers, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. Or do you suppose that it is for nothing that the scripture says God yearns jealously for the spirit that he has made to dwell in us, but he gives all the more grace. Therefore, it says God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourself, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning, and your joy into dejection. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you. Do not speak evil against one another, brothers and sisters. Whoever speaks evil against another or judges another speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is one lawgiver and judge who is able to save and to destroy. So who then are you to judge your neighbor? Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a town and spend a year there doing business and making money. Yet you do not even know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wishes, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Anyone then who knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, commits sin.
Thank you, Donna. Let's let that sink in for a couple of moments in silence as we let the introverts collect their thoughts. Okay. Good news. We heard Jeanette's computer dinging, so that bodes well. And now, what do you think about chapter 4? What jumps out at you?
Well, I figured out when I was reading, I was on Peter instead of James.
That's okay. I'm glad you figured it out. That's good.
I have one comment. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I have one comment. In verse 7, it says, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. That's not true. Right?
I haven't found it to be true always. I have found it to be true in a spotty way. What about you guys? Where are you on this subject?
I think it's a little overstated.
Okay, Donna thinks it's a little overstated. Sue couldn't quite hear. Okay, so the point is, in verse 7 of chapter 4, we've got the fabulous instruction. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. I find this fascinating as an exorcist and a spiritual director and someone who, you know, deals with the power struggle between good and evil on a regular basis with eyes wide open as to who is behind the power struggle. You know, what I have discovered is that when our no means no, and I don't mean that in a shallow way, I mean that with when we can say no with every fiber of our being and nothing even unconscious within us is having a different thought. There's no hold that darkness can have upon our soul because we are 100% facing in the correct direction without any issues and any troubles and any reservations. There is no stain upon our heart. There is no grudge we have not forgiven in that moment. There is no pain we are clinging to. Because we can give up everything except this one thing. Oh, but not this one thing, because we were really wronged and we're holding on to that one. When our no really means no, and it is a firm boundary, then we've got a 60% chance of successfully resisting the devil and the devil retreating for round 18 sometime later. But the thing is, that's a lot of internal honesty that not everybody participates in, that not everybody knows how to participate in, that not everybody wants to. Like, it's not their life goal to figure out how to clean out their internal closets as if every day were Lent and live in the purest fashion that they can manage. And added to all of this is also God's will for us, which is ineffable, as many have pointed out before. And it's hard to know if the thing that we're struggling with, why can't we get through it? Why do good things happen to bad people? Like, that's question number one. And why can't we successfully resist the devil? And why do we still have to deal with all of these obstacles in our lives, even if we're good people and we love Jesus and we are resisting the devil the best we can? Why is life still hard? Why do people still die? Why do our hearts grieve with such pain and such anguish? Why do we keep worrying? There are lots of answers to that. And modern psychology will give us some very, very good ones. Looking at it from an entirely religious point of view, it's hard to give a clear-cut answer because, you know, I am not an entirely religious person. I am deeply informed by science. I am deeply informed by psychology. I am deeply informed by sociology. And so, is it all God's will? Essentially, but I don't blame our troubles on God. I usually look to the troubles that we have made in our own lives and see, does some of this come from here? Does some of this come from my lack of forgiveness 20 years ago that I'm paying for now? And it's sad that I chose what I chose 20 years ago, but I did. And now I have to pay that debt. And maybe the interest has grown. It's one answer. It's not the only answer.
I think there's nothing more frustrating than praying and praying and praying and feeling like you're not getting an answer. And I have, I shouldn't say often, but many times resorted to saying, okay, God, I don't see any answer. And so I can only, or I am going to assume that the answer is the no answer. It's like a no, because you're not showing me something else.
Answer. Discernment can be really difficult, and we don't teach it well in the church. Or at least it's not been my experience that we teach it well in the church. Perhaps some churches teach it very well.
The answer, I think, often is something indirect that we don't perceive as being an answer. Hmm. You know, I think it's sometimes it's sort of oblique and you don't get it because it's not a direct answer. And as to your other talking about, you know, why the devil doesn't flee, I'm not sure as humans we're capable of that kind of purity to a particular idea or thought or anything in our lives. I just, you know, our minds wander. They wander off in all directions. We do dumb stuff. And I think we can all admit to that. So, you know, I think it's probably an impossible task to say that if you're pure in heart and spirit, that the devil will flee. It might be, but I'm not sure any of us will ever get there to test it. So, you know, just because we're human. You know, yes, we don't see all of our faults, and we don't see all of our good, crazy things that we do that we're probably not good. You know, I don't know. So I don't expect direct. I guess I don't expect direct answers, Marilyn. Well, I often think, you know, I feel the same way you do. That sometimes I pray for something and it doesn't. You know, I don't seem to get a clear answer. And then sometimes in retrospect, I think, well, I was led down a different path because of X, Y, or Z. But you know, I don't have a clear concept of it either.
Well, I think sometimes God has a different plan for you than what you're playing for. He has a better plan for you.
Yeah, I try to be open to that. But When I said I'm going to assume the answer is no, that's not what I meant. What I say is, if you don't show me something else, this is what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm open to whatever you're showing me.
And the tricky thing about that is cognitive scientists have identified that as a cognitive fallacy. So I can't remember the name of the cognitive fallacy because that would be way too convenient, and I apologize. But this idea that, okay, I'm going to take a really basic example. So I'm going to ask God what I should make for dinner. That's what I'm trying to discern about in this moment. Basic example, something we can all relate to, perhaps. Maybe it's where should I go for dinner, or where should I order from for dinner, or what should I make for dinner, whatever. We all have to eat. So I'm asking God this. Now, I can go into this with a couple of different mindsets. I can go into this with a totally blank slate mind. I got nothing. I got no agenda. I am the tabula rasa for God. Just use your finger and write on me macaroni and cheese, whatever. So when I do that, that sets me up for a different kind of response than if I approach God and say, what should I make for dinner? And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, ooh, mac and cheese, wouldn't that be great? Like, I could add chicken to it, or maybe I could put some broccoli in it, or ooh, I could make it a little spicy this time. I wonder if I should bake it. Maybe I should make it up and then make the cheese sauce, and then I should bake it because then the flavors will come together in a really nice way. And so I'm not coming to God with a blank slate. I'm not waiting for any answer, which might be toast. It might be, don't eat dinner today. I saw the size of your lunch. You don't need it. It might be, call your best friend and invite her out to dinner, when maybe I had been thinking, even in my tabula rasa, I had been thinking, what should I make for dinner? And so I'm already bringing into my question assumptions that it's going to be like from ingredients in my kitchen. I'm going to be eating out of the pantry tonight. I'm going to be making it. And it's going to be something that I have the energy to make, and something I already know how to make, and something that I have a recipe to make, and something that I've made more than 3 times so I can make it easily, because actually I don't have a whole lot of energy right now. And it takes me some energy to think and plan and, you know. And so even in that tabula rasa example, I still came with some assumptions of my own, when maybe the best option would have been, God wants me to call up my best friend and be like, hey, crazy idea, let's do dinner. Maybe that's what God really wanted. But since I wasn't even open to the idea of calling my friend and doing a different thing than I'm used to doing, I could only really hear an answer that has to do with me eating something I'm used to eating out of my pantry without reference to anybody else. And then if you add another layer on that, I'm daydreaming about mac and cheese. Then it doesn't really matter what God says, because I can't hear anything that doesn't say either salmon mac and cheese or chicken mac and cheese or broccoli mac and cheese, or yes, you bake that mac and cheese casserole, Sarah, you do it. I approve. So if I don't have one of those 4 answers from God, I can't even hear it, because that is what I have prepared my mind to accept. And the reason this is a cognitive fallacy is when scientists go into their research, they've got a hypothesis. Yes, they need to have a clear statement of, under these circumstances, we think this will happen. But then they have to remove themselves to not affect the outcome in a false way, because we will affect the outcome in a false way. And that's why we do blind studies, and we do double blind studies, and we do all of this. We go through all of these flaming hoops in research to try to erase this bias that researchers have for getting the answer that they want. And the tricky thing is, with the dinner question, in the first example, I had presented it first as having no bias at all. I am just a tabula rasa. I am open to God's will. But I didn't even realize that I'd actually already put some stipulations on it. And that is a tricky thing when we go into prayer and we really need discernment. Like, we are asking for direction. We want God's direction. We're trying to listen. We're doing our darndest to genuinely listen for really anything, any thought, any song on the radio, any call from somebody else, any input at all. Like, Alexa accidentally turning on and reading a recipe out to us would be fine. Like, anything could be discernment from God. Okay. But when we come into it with these preconceived notions that we actually know what would be best for us, we have already hemmed in God's gigantic playing field and tried to corral God into the small little space that we find comfortable and reasonable and doable. And of course, this works outside of choosing dinner. And so part of the discernment process is to remove as much of ourselves from the desire for the answer as humanly possible. And again, like, Donna's point is perfectly valid. That's a lot of work. That is a lot of effort. And it's a lot to ask for most people, because it does require some kind of mastery of the mind, which you can get through prayer. You can get through centering prayer. You can get through all kinds of different meditation. But mastery of the mind is step number one. So that'll take you 20 years. And on top of that, you have to be able to discern between spirits, because it's not just God who wants to talk to you and influence your behavior. And so there's also that.
You know, I find, oh, go ahead. Jeanette, you're talking. Go ahead.
Can you hear me? Okay. Do you think that there are situations in which God plays a hands-off role and like free will? You know, I mean, we as people, do you think God ever does that?
Okay. So the question, in case anyone missed that, was, do you think there are situations where God takes a more hands-off role? Do you think God ever does that? So here's the thing. No and no, which is kind of like yes and no, but different. No, because God cares about every one of us all the time. And we all, whether or not it's something that we actively think about, we all know how small choices can make a large influence on how our day goes, on if accidents happen, if we hurt someone else, a slip of the tongue, as James would remind us, and we can rip someone's heart out. Like, that is a very small maneuver to cause great pain and suffering. And so God cares deeply about us, and God wants every single one of us to, if you will, live up to our full potential, to become the best person we are personally capable of becoming, which might look really big and magnificent for some people and might look quite small for others. But if it's the best they're capable of becoming in that moment, so be it. Now, the other side of the no is, and I'm thinking about here about sports teams, and I'm thinking about wars, because sports and war have a lot in common. So you get a team like the Buffalo Bills, wonderful team. And then you get a team like the LA Rams. Did I get that right? I think it's the Rams. Perhaps it doesn't matter. Perhaps you don't follow football. Doesn't matter. So you get a matchup of two teams. And you get people on each side who are praying for their team to win, which is not so far removed from two nations who are at war. And then you get people on both sides of the two nations praying for God to help them win a war. Which, of course, just reminds me of World War II and Christmas Eve and the brief, spontaneous peace we had as both sides sang Silent Night. That was only broken when soldiers were ordered on pain of torture to shoot somebody right now because they didn't want to anymore. So does God answer that prayer? Well, my bias, what I think about God, is that God wants each one of us to become the best person that we can. And that the presence of God in the midst of World War II was on Christmas Eve. That was the presence of God. That was when people listened and discerned and acted in beautiful, peaceful, life-giving ways. And then they stopped listening to God and started listening to the commanding officers again. What about with the sports team? I think that God is present in all of those athletes' lives. Do I think that God is responsible for the touchdowns? Not actually. Do I think that God is responsible for one team winning over another? Not actually. And sometimes, like with Simone Biles in the Olympics, I think that God was in Simone's decision to not compete. Because if you remember that in the Summer Olympics, she is perhaps the world's best gymnast. And she decided not to compete because the strain was too much. And if she messed up, she'd break her neck and die. Best case scenario, quadriplegic. And so in that moment, she listened to the deep wisdom that said, don't do that. That's where I think God was in that moment. Not in the pressure to win, not in the capacity to overcome challenges, but in the internal strength to recognize I have come up against an obstacle I cannot overcome. If I want to continue to live, I must stop here. I must show humility. I must be willing to gather ill will from people who don't understand. That must be the strength that I portray. And so, God answers prayer. The answer is sometimes something we're not prepared to hear. And the answer is sometimes no. Stop. What were you going to say, Grace?
Well, I have found that God has answered my prayers, but it's not what I, not in a way that I expected. And it's not an instant answer. Sometimes you have to wait and be patient, and it has to be in God's time. Mm-hmm. But he does answer, but you just have to look for the answer. I have found I have to look for the answer sometimes in different ways.
Sue and then Jeanette.
I have had the similar experiences to Grace's, and it's not until quite a bit retrospectively that I start putting pieces together. And I realized that right from the beginning, I had answers. I just wasn't hearing them, seeing them, or finding them. And as I lay out a long past situation, all the answers are right there. And they all led to a better place than I was thinking I wanted to go.
Jeanette?
Quick comment. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes.
In your discussion, you're talking about with the sports teams, the people for each team praying that the team wins. Well, that's a good example of God doing a hands-off situation, right? So he doesn't do hands-off in certain situations.
Maybe. I mean, yeah, I could see how you would look at it that way. I kind of see it, I don't know. Okay, I can't think of a way to say this that isn't possibly offensive, which sometimes happens in my mind.
Yeah. So,
I apologize in advance if this offends you. So it's actually very close to what James says. Let's see. You ask and do not receive. This is verse 3. You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly in order to spend what you get on your pleasures. So in a kind of same but different way, when we ask for things that God doesn't notice, which is the offensive part, perhaps, because I think that God notices all that is real, and God does not notice things that are not real, which explains a lot about our struggles with evil, because I'm not sure that evil is real to God, because God is. And God is love, and that there is nothing that is not God that is in God. And if there is nothing that is not God that is in God, if God is entirely non-dualistic, then evil is part of our horrible nightmare that we need to get over. So that can be offensive for anyone who does not embrace a non-dualistic view. But to answer Jeanette's question, does God sometimes have a hands-off approach? Yes, if what you're asking for is not something that God can even see. I'm sorry, say that again.
God is all-knowing. He sees everything.
And here we get into deep philosophical debate. God is all-knowing. God is all-doing, or if you like, all-powerful. God is all. Okay. Yeah. And let me spin a scenario out. It's possible I'm getting into heretical territory, so love me anyway. Here's the scenario. What if you and I, right now, as we are on the Zoom call, are actually asleep in God's arms right now? Right now. And we are having a nightmare because we asked a funny question before we fell asleep. We asked the question, what is not God? Because we were with God in God's arms and only experienced that which is God, the perfect love, the perfect joy, the perfect peace. And so, because we are powerful, we are children of God, we fell asleep and we had a dream about what is not God. Because in this scenario, only God is, and we are part of God as children of God. And so we exist in God, but we are powerful. And so we can dream what it is to not be in God. And what would not God even look like? What would it feel like? And so we fell asleep and we had a dream. And it turns out that not God is terrible. Not God is awful. Not God is evil. And the very first thing that happened in the dream was that evil was born. Because we wanted to experience it, because we wanted to know what was not God. And so the very first thing that evil did was say, you need to forget this original question, Just come and experience not God with me. And so we are in a nightmare right now as we lie sleeping in God's arms, and God is just gently stroking our face and telling us it is safe to wake up now. It is safe to wake up now. And because we are part of God and we cannot actually escape being part and inside of God, there is a part of us that remembers that we are God. We are within God. We did not make ourselves. God made us, but we're inside of God. We are children of God. We are of God. And so a part of us that dwells in everybody remembers who we really are. And it is that part of us that some call the Holy Spirit that is teasing us back home to wake up, to just wake up, to let go of this nightmare that is not real and wake up. And God is not in the nightmare. God is holding us as we sleep, stroking us and saying, it's safe to wake up now. You can wake up now. Just like a parent gently, gently trying to wake a child out of a nightmare, because you wake them too fast and they wake up screaming, and then maybe they're not really awake and they're still trapped in the nightmare. So gently, gently, gently wake up the child. And all the while in the dream, there is the lucid dreamer inside of us who remembers perfectly well who we really are and who is gently working to wake us up. And that is God's presence in the dream, but it's not really the fullness of God. It is, if you will, the spirit of God in the dream with us. And that fullness, that spirit, should I say, within me is the same spirit that is within you, because we're all actually the one child of God that fell asleep in God's arms. And so there is actually, really no difference between me and Jeanette and Grace and Donna and Marilyn and Sue. There's actually no difference, except that we're all having a nightmare of separation and pain and anxiety and evil and terror. And we're killing each other, except we're actually killing ourselves over and over. And there is this voice that says, wake up. And so whenever we ask a question of that voice that can give us an answer that leads closer to wake up and farther away from fall further asleep, we get a choice, even if it's just, what should I have for dinner? Because what should I have for dinner helps us to practice asking questions of the right person, the Holy Spirit, the indwelling spirit that we all have. And asking a question about wanting to win a war, you've presupposed an answer because you want to win a war, which means you want to kill people. Asking a question about wanting to win a sports game presupposes the answer, because you've already declared that you want to make someone a loser, that you want to triumph over them, that you want to be seen as better and not as equal and as loving. And so in this scenario, is God omnipotent? Yes. And no. God is omnipotent in what is real. Are the dreams real? Well, they seem real. They seem tangible. But is anything real that is not inside of God? Well, that's a good question. So that is the scenario that I spin. And that is an image of non-duality, having an experience of duality. And in it, questions of, is God omnipotent and is God all-knowing? You kind of put a pin in them and say, okay, but define reality first. Is reality what I can touch? Or is reality something else? Because I can't touch justice, and I can't touch love, and I can't touch hope.
It's still part of reality.
Well, my point in bringing up justice and love and hope is that if we talk about reality in terms of the tangible things that we perceive, even so, that begins to get a little tricky when we talk about intangible things that we value. And so my point isn't necessarily to say that the intangible things that we value define reality or don't define reality. My point is to help broaden the mind just a tiny bit to the idea that maybe none of this is quite as real as we thought. But that is also where we get into heretical territory, so you don't have to agree with me, and that's fine.
Your scenario seemed like a metaphor for the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve and the devil at the apple tree.
Or is the Garden of Eden a metaphor for my scenario?
There you go.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
You think.
Hold on, Marilyn. Jeanette's trying to say something. Jeanette, you need to look directly at the microphone.
Verse 11. Whoever speaks evil against another or judges another speaks evil against the law. What does that mean? To speak? And it doesn't make sense, that sentence.
Well, think about as well what we just heard in church last week. For anyone who did not attend, it was the second portion of the Sermon on the Plain. You know, the first portion is woe to the rich and blessed are the poor. The second portion is judge not, lest ye be judged. Condemn not, lest ye be condemned. Forgive and you will be forgiven. So if we think about those words of Jesus, and then also tie this in, because I think that that's particularly helpful. So the whole verse is, verse 11, do not speak evil against one another, brothers and sisters. Whoever speaks evil against one another judges another, speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. Okay. So first of all, we're told not to judge. Like, that has already been uttered to us by Jesus. We know that that is the moral good. Don't judge. What we have here is James juxtaposing Jesus's interpretation, presumably, and the more ancient Hebrew interpretation. So the law is the most important thing for the ancient Jewish people. And Jesus's interpretation of the law, pardon me, is all about loving your neighbor as yourself and loving God. So if you speak evil against your neighbor, whoever speaks evil against their neighbor judges one another. So let's think about just that for half a moment. Okay. Yes, Jeanette.
Can I interrupt for a second? The judgment of that verse that I was questioning, that's the it was the phrase, whoever speaks evil against another speaks evil against the law. I don't care about the judging. The judging I understand. But okay. Just about that part of it. Whoever speaks evil against another speaks evil against the law. that speaks even against the law.
Okay. Okay. So I will get right there.
Okay.
So the whole point here is that if it's a logical argument that he doesn't fill in the details of. So if you speak evil of a brother or sister, then you're not obeying the law. You are instead judging who you have to love and who you don't have to love. And so that is not being a doer of the law. That is being a judge of the law, because you have decided that you are above it and you may interpret it. When in fact, we look at Jesus and say, no. Jesus is the ultimate interpreter of this law, not me. And so I have to go with Jesus's interpretation, not my own. So then where we come to that with James is saying, if you judge one another, if you do evil against your brother, you judge one another. If you do this, you speak evil against the law. So speaking evil against the law is like saying, this law is not right. It is not good. Now, James had, as we have noticed, many people in the New Testament world has kind of draconian views to people who don't agree with them. It was not a place where it was super safe to disagree. It wasn't me saying, okay, I'm about to throw something heretical at you, you're allowed to disagree. That is not what was going on there. So James is saying, if you disagree with this, you're not just putting yourself in the place of a judge. You are speaking evil against the law. You are saying that the law of Moses, handed down by God himself, is evil. And therefore, we are just waiting for your head to fall out of your butt. And that's the depth and the insulting nature that James brings to his arguments, his rhetorical arguments. And so he's playing dirty. He's not just saying, no, you're wrong. And he's not just saying, also, that's not good. Like, that's morally, that's you've crossed the line into not good. It was good, but now it's not good. He's not saying that. He's saying that you are not just insulting God or testing God. You are calling evil the primary good thing that God gave us in antiquity. And yes, Jesus is interpreting it, and we need to listen to Jesus. But Jesus worships the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who has been with us all of our lives, and our fathers, and our fathers' fathers, and our fathers' 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 fathers. And you have the temerity to insult and spit upon and call evil that which is holy good. Change your ways. That's what he's saying.
Thank you.
And he doesn't mince words. Do we have a final comment or thought about chapter 4? Sue.
I just keep thinking that we try to sort out, not that it's wrong to try to sort out and to understand, I don't mean that, but it just seems to me that we are like the Tower of Babel, trying to be equal to God, to be able to understand God, to not that we are, but that it's that futile attempt, a human attempt to be better than we are, to be more capable. And over in the Psalms, it keeps telling you in different places that God knows we are human. God knows we will be at fault. God knows that we are not perfect. And yet we keep trying to perfect ourselves, and it's an exercise in futility, and we go to war about it and destroy other people. It just seems like to some extent, and so I'm confused.
And that's okay. That's okay. Let us think about these things in the next week. If you have further questions, please do feel free to write them down for our next session. Jeanette, will you send that group email that I will respond to and that we can all weigh in on? And next week, we finish up the Book of James.
All right. Are we meeting next week because it's Ash Wednesday?
It's Ash Wednesday. I'm still prepared to meet.
Okay.
All right. I'll see you guys later.
Thank you.
Bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.